Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. At the June ASCO meeting in Chicago, there was a major plenary presentation of an EORTC study evaluating prophylactic cranial irradiation in patients with extensive small cell carcinoma responding to systemic therapy. I met with Dr. Wally Curran for his take on this controversial presentation, and he began our conversation by reviewing the background to this work.
Prophylactic cranial radiation now is a standard approach to patients with limited stage small cell lung cancer who achieve a complete or a near complete response to their chest radiotherapy and chemotherapy. And at least two meta-analyses demonstrated a overall absolute 5% increase in survival with that approach over a series of studies, as well as in general about a 50% or greater reduction in the development of central nervous system metastases. The decision was made by the EORTC to conduct a trial to determine whether prophylactic cranial radiation could confer the same level of benefit to patients who had a response in extensive stage disease. So the randomization of approximately 200 patients took place. These were patients who received chemotherapy for extensive stage disease and had a response. The details of the extent of response and the response assessment were not totally clear in the presentation to me. They were then randomized between...
So it's not necessarily a PR by RECIST?
There was no data to suggest that. It was really an investigator assessment of response.
And what fraction of the patients that were treated responded, or we don't really know that?
I'm not sure we know
that. Because you start out just with people
who
responded.
Yeah, I think the randomization took place among responders.
Got it.
Then the randomization was between the administration of prophylactic cranial radiation at a fairly aggressive fractionation of 20 gray in 5-4 gray fractions versus observation. Another important factor in the design was there was no brain imaging at the time of eligibility determination or randomization. So for knowing the high frequency of CNS metastases, it is possible that patients already had asymptomatic metastases at the time of randomization.
That's kind of an unusual aspect of the trial, huh?
One interpretation in a recent discussion I participated in from one individual was, could this PCI, in fact, have been early treatment of subclinical disease?
I guess it seems like that would be the case, but
right.
I guess in terms of gross versus microscopic, we don't know.
Exactly. So in the randomization, in the report we saw, there was a statistically significant improvement in not only progression-free survival, but survival, which was really a startling observation given the fact that patients, even in a good response state for extensive stage small cell, have so many competing risks for mortality. But it's clearly a suggestion that perhaps, I mean, there's several ways to interpret it. A positive study that defines a new paradigm of treatment for extensive stage disease, a positive study which is so counterintuitive that it needs confirmation, or a positive study that has to do with some design methodologies, for example, lack of really careful restaging of the patients to assess response, look at the CNS, and perhaps some asymmetry in the actual randomization and stratification.
What was the magnitude of the impact specifically?
It was significant. It extended the median survival several months, and it was a p-value well below p equals 0.001.
So how have you been approaching this situation before this study? Are you still doing the same thing or changing?
So there are patients who have what is officially designated as extensive stage disease. Remember, that's an old VA lung cancer group definition of being encompassable or not in a reasonable radiation field. There are patients who, with extensive stage disease, who have what I might refer to as oligometastases, small volume, maybe one metastases, who have an excellent CR, near CR to their therapy, be it chemo or perhaps a little radiation with chemo, who I do have a discussion as to an aggressive approach, including prophylactic cranial radiation, assuming they have a normal MRI after staging.
So you've been doing that even before this?
Been doing that in very highly selected patients. We'll continue to do that. As far as the broader group of extensive stage patients, I have not yet changed my practice. We had discussions within RTOG, the Radiation Therapy Oncology Group meeting, where we met 2 weeks ago, where we had lots of discussions on doing exploratory confirmation studies of this, perhaps not a big phase 3, but perhaps a phase 2 study of this type to really see whether there's a suggestion that it's improving outcome. Unfortunately, as you know, Neil, there haven't been a lot of great steps forward in the last decade or so with extensive stage small cell. We had promising phase 3 data looking at the new drug irinotecan in Japan, but otherwise there hasn't been a lot. So while this is a rather focused attempt at improving outcome, I think doing a study perhaps more rigorously might be something of value.
So was there any kind of overall consensus within the RTOG group in terms of most of them feel the way you feel, that it really hasn't been a change in standard of care and be highly selective, or more people now really rethinking this?
I think it's across the spectrum. I heard people say it's changed how I approach such patients.
I heard a lot of people say that.
Yeah, I've heard people say that. I've heard people just find the design so different than American standard of practice that they don't know how to apply that.
I guess the other issue there, obviously, is what's the downside? Now, right. In addition to inconvenience and expense,
sure.
What would you say to a patient right now in terms of potential side effects, complications, CNS effects?
Right.
And would that change based on the patient's age or other comorbidities?
Right. It will change based on the patient's age, but also the radiation fractionation scheme. The scheme that they used in this study is a scheme that I have never used, nor has any American study ever used in a prophylactic cranial radiation role. Most people view the risk of cranial complications to be related to the fraction size of radiation delivered, as well as a patient's age. The older the age, the higher the risk of complications. This was a regimen given in a week in 4 gray fractions. And the only time that I see that commonly done in the United States is for a patient who has cerebral metastases, is in poor condition, and there's a desire to get the treatment done rapidly.
What's the usual treatment you do?
For prophylactic cranial radiation, the usual treatment I would do would be 2.5 gray in 10 fractions. We have been working in a trial with a French group to look at doing a twice-daily regimen up to 36 gray, or a lower dose per fraction of 2 gray, also up to 36 gray, and we don't have the results of that yet.
So utilizing that approach, just basically on a clinical level, you have a 65-year-old perfectly healthy person who says, okay, what can I expect in terms of potential complications? And you have an older patient, 75, maybe 80, I'm not sure how old somebody would be to be treated, maybe even older, who asked you the same question. How would you respond in a very practical way in terms of some basic numbers?
Sure. So the greatest risk from full cranial radiation these days is effect on short-term memory, neurocognitive effect. And I think the second most common effect, which is underappreciated, is neuroendocrine effect, hypopituitarism. That comes later, but the neurocognitive effect can come immediately.
When exactly do you see the later neuroendocrine effect?
Starting at about a year in general.
What do patients say?
Usually it's symptoms of hypothyroidism. So whatever, it's fatigue, lassitude, hair falling out, just apathy.
What's the incidence of both of these things? Again, a 65,
right.
80-year-old.
So I would say in terms of significant effect on short-term memory from a 2.5 gray times 10 regimen in a otherwise healthy 65-year-old, I would put the risk at 10 to 15%. In a 75 to 80-year-old, I would put the risk more up at around 25 to 30%.
And how long does it last, or does it go away?
Some of it improves, depending on the general health of that person. I think, actually, mood and depression can have a significant role in this as well. As you know, Neil, any health perturbation can have an effect on short-term memory. And the way I sometimes describe the neurocognitive effects of prophylactic cranial radiation is it sometimes ages the brain about a decade in short-term memory. So if you're 45, you might have a short-term memory as if you were 55. But if you're 75 and you get a short-term memory of being an 85-year-old, that's a very different functional level on average.
And any speculations, or what do we know about what the potential mechanisms are about how this is occurring? What's going on in the brain?
So one recent hypothesis is that the hippocampus is actually a site where this may be a site of primary disturbance. And based on that and some very good neuroanatomic work done by investigators both at University of Wisconsin and elsewhere, we actually have started doing some what we call radiation dose painting design studies. We're actually reducing the dose to the hippocampus. First thing you have to do is you have to identify it. And we do have our neuroradiologists who are helpful in that.
Hippocampus does what? It's like the mood thing and all that?
Yeah, we learned that it's a critical area in cognition as well. We have some animal studies that would suggest a very low dose of radiation to the hippocampus can be a go, no-go on neurocognitive effects of cranial radiation. And if you can reduce the dose to the hippocampus, the dramatic effects that we're talking about are less apparent. So right now we have the ability, and we're talking about doing this in a very pilot way, of keeping the dose as low as possible to the hippocampus while treating the rest of the cranial sites to see whether that has a neurocognitive value.
You're actually going to do a randomized study or just, I mean, approach it in a clinical research manner?
It will be a clinical research study, phase two.
Interesting.
With mini mental status tests, other battery of tests, with the idea that if we see a signal that this is something that is better, then we'll figure out how to move that forward.
So, again, trying to tease out a little bit more clinically what this really means to a patient. These numbers sound pretty substantial, 10 to 25%.
Right.
Is that roughly the fraction of people who will turn around at the end of this thing and go, wow, that really had a pretty bad effect on me, or would it be really higher or lower than that? Which fraction of people at the end of this, assuming they survive a couple of years, will turn around and say, wow, I really lost a lot by being treated that way?
I'd say among those 65 and younger, it's a minority. Among those over 65, they and their family will clearly describe, or there's a likelihood they'll describe, a neurocognitive effect. Now, keep in mind you're looking at competing risks, because brain metastases, particularly from small cell, really have no satisfactory salvage. Even though they're radiation responsive, they rarely are solitary as breast and non-small cell are, so they rarely can be salvaged effectively, let's say by surgery or radiosurgery. So if you're talking about a 50% reduction in symptomatic brain mets, weighing that against a definable neurocognitive effect, what I've also been pleased about, and the success I've seen in my own patients has mainly been with women, is that neurocognitive effects of things, be it cranial radiation, chemotherapy, surgery, tumors, can be reversible by a battery of neurocognitive training. And I have several psychologists that I deal with in the Philadelphia area as referral, and a well-disciplined patient can go there and learn training that can reverse some of these effects as well.
That's interesting. Does that work with the normal aging also?
I think they're certainly trying to do that. And the second thing is there are some of the drugs that are being looked at for Parkinson's, which are being used to manage this as well. And there actually is a trial under design to look at a Parkinson's drug in the management of brain radiation for known brain metastases as an intervention to reduce this neurocognitive effect.
When you look at people who are, quote, responding to extensive stage small cell, what's the spectrum of survival that you see in these people?
Yeah, unfortunately, the median survival is, even in the best series, not much over a year. And the long-term survivorship is down to single digits after a few years. I think the typical series show a 10 to 15% two-year survival and single-digit longer-term survival.
So we're really in a palliative mode here. And what do we know about the fraction of people in this situation whose primary cause of disability and death is brain mets?
Difficult to sort out, but I think if you look at brain mets as being one of the life-threatening or life-ending disabilities, Most series that I see talk about that being 25 or 30%, so a substantial number.
You were talking before about trying to avoid the hippocampus. What do you know about Mets in that area?
Don't know a whole lot. They can occur anywhere, but it's not a primary area of metastases. Really, the most common area of brain metastases is at the gray-white matter junction. And fortunately, hippocampal metastases is not a common site.
I'm curious, in terms of your perspective as a radiation oncologist, about what you've been seeing of the evolution of clinical research on bevacizumab, not just in lung cancer, but in general, and sort of where you think it's heading, and specifically how you think it's going to work in terms of in some way being incorporated with, following, or integrated with radiation therapy.
Sure. So particularly after ASCO in 2005, with several positive studies in colorectal, lung, and breast cancer, tremendous excitement in the community to look at it in a combined modality setting. Now that we're 2 years after that point, there's really a disappointing number of trials, but we have some. The RTOG has completed a phase two trial looking at bevacizumab integrated with chemoradiation in pancreatic cancer that we'll be preparing to report soon. We did it. We've completed it. We have the information. The landmark paper that really, I think, spurred it on was work done by Chris Willett and Dr. Rakesh Jain up at Mass General, where they showed in a small number of rectal cancer patients that there actually was a physiologic effect of the Avastin alone in terms of the vasculature, and then showed a clinical effect when they combined it with radiation.
Yeah, that really was a stunning study. I actually interviewed Chris Willett for our colon series.
Right.
And I guess the big thing that came out of that was the fact that not only is there an anti-angiogenic effect, but that there's a normalization of the vasculature, which I guess has very important implications in terms of not just chemo, but also radiation
Absolutely.
Therapy.
Yeah, since tumor hypoxia is thought to be one of the primary mechanisms of resistance to radiation, you're absolutely right. So where is it beyond that? RTOG now has a trial open looking at bevacizumab and chemoradiation in nasopharyngeal cancer, which is thought to be a tumor that has a highly vascular proliferative rate. Right now, with good IMRT-based radiation and chemo, our tumor control, the primary in nasopharyngeal cancer, is really quite good. So we're really looking at reducing both lymph node and distant metastases as a way to improve that outcome. All the cooperative groups who study lung cancer were interested in looking at bevacizumab and chemoradiation in stage 3 disease. Every one of the groups put together proposals to NCI. Ultimately, the first group to get approval was SWOG, and they are doing a study that's a cautious integration of bevacizumab into chemoradiation, dividing patients between high risk and low risk according to whether they have central tumor, squamous histology, history of hemoptysis, and other factors. And because of very cautious enrollment, even though the study was approved 23 months ago, there's a very small number of patients already enrolled.
Why is that?
When there have been reports of episodes of tracheoesophageal fissure in some small cell studies with bevacizumab and chemoradiation, that required SWOG to stop it, look at every patient under study, assess whether it's safe to continue, and that has taken a regulatory few months to do. So ultimately, that study will get done, but it starts with the bevacizumab in the adjuvant period, then puts it on day 15 of the chemo radiation, and then finally to day 1. Unfortunately, it will take a few years to do that. There's also work being done with bevacizumab, very promising work, in brain tumors, particularly in second-line glioblastoma multiforme in conjunction with CPT-11, that will be brought frontline in some upcoming studies with radiation. And given well-described vascular targets, overexpression of VEGF-1 and 2 in glioblastoma, that certainly has a strong biologic rationale as well.
What's your sort of gut response right now in terms of the potential benefits and risks of bevacizumab combined with chemoradiation therapy and lung cancer? Yes, we're going to have to wait who knows how long to really get the answer. But based on the few reports you've seen, I don't know what you think about the TE fistula stuff and what that might mean. What's your overall take on what the potential? I mean, lung cancer is not a good disease, period, whether you get any treatment and you get all kinds of problems.
Yeah.
Any gut feeling about the potential risk and potential benefit?
Yeah, my gut feeling is it can be a very active addition to chemo radiation. My biggest concern is that people will get appropriately concerned about the risk of catastrophic complications, and I'm concerned that will slow the clinical development. And TE fistulas are obviously serious life-threatening events. The time that we saw those in thoracic malignancies originally is when we started combining chemo with radiation back a couple decades ago, and it made some people back off that paradigm. Once we then learned how to do it, it revolutionized the care of those patients. And
that's interesting. So TE fistulas were seen with chemo radiation?
Yes.
And in retrospect, do you think that was really real and it was just the way it was being used?
Yes.
Wow, and,
interesting. And if you go back even further in the radiation alone history of unresected thoracic malignancies, back when I was in training, the elders to me taught us that if someone has potential tumor invading the esophagus,
sure,
tumor invading the trachea, go treat the patient with a lower dose per fraction as to avoid a tracheoesophageal fistula.
So try to get less tumor response.
Exactly. So I view the TE fistula as a surrogate for excellent tumor response. We just need to figure out how we calibrate the anti-tumor effects so it doesn't have a catastrophic effect.
And, you know, on the other side of things and in terms of how quickly we need to move on this, when you look in total at the people who are receiving chemo radiation in this situation, what's their prognosis?
Even in the best studies for stage 3 non-small cell and those well enough to meet the relatively rigorous eligibility, you're looking at median survival times of under 2 years, 5-year survival rates of 15%, and that's the select few. So I think if you looked at a cross-section of patients treated around the country, you're probably still talking about single-digit 5-year survival rates.
Yeah, so, I mean, of course, we don't want to induce any morbidity, but this is not a good situation and
it
calls for something different.
I absolutely agree, and I hope that investigators, our federal agencies, pharma, and the patients are able to keep that attitude.
I'm curious, your perspective again as a radiation oncologist, as I always like to talk to surgeons and rad-oncs about what med-oncs are doing to get another perspective, particularly not just in terms of clinical care, but also research about what you think about what's going on in terms of trials in the adjuvant setting in non-small cell. Obviously, the biggest question right now is the same as in colon and breast. What about bevacizumab in addition to chemo? And we have the ECOG trial that's up.
Right.
What are your thoughts about that?
I think it's a good trial, and I have only two concerns about the study. Number one, that it accrues well enough, which I think it will. And number two, my concern that there are patients who can be enrolled in that study, namely those with multiple resected N2 lymph nodes, who I think the prevalent evidence would suggest that they would be perhaps better served in a adjuvant regimen that contains radiation. That study does not allow for that. And I think that's unfortunate in that particular study. That doesn't mean that a patient, seeing such a patient, you know, has their hand forced, nor does the patient have their hand forced to enroll the patient if they think the patient would be better off with radiation. But sometimes study eligibility sort of defines practice. And while we see emerging data from many of the other adjuvant trials looking at chemo versus no chemo where radiation was sort of optional or up to investigator. When we've done hypothesis-generating analyses of these, it would suggest that those patients receiving chemo and radiation had the best survival, for example, in the ANITA trial as compared to the other groups.
Another issue in the adjuvant setting, and I think kind of reminds me a little bit about the adjuvant trastuzumab strategy in breast cancer, is the use of adjuvant therapy using erlotinib in enriched populations of patients, non-smokers, EGFR mutations, FISH overexpression, et cetera. Can you talk a little bit about that strategy and what your thoughts are about it?
I think it's a fabulous approach, and there is this adjuvant study open now looking at erlotinib in the adjuvant setting versus no erlotinib, which allows chemotherapy in both arms as well. One problem is 1Bs. If you look at sort of the come-all studies done in Europe, either Terry LeChevalier study or the Anita study, 1Bs are a small number in many of those studies, so it may not end up being a big enough group. That being said, there are no other studies for patients to enroll on with the small 1B. So I hope they do enroll on that so we have some information. Now, in that case, every patient's tumor will be studied, but it will be really used as a stratification rather than an eligibility variable, which personally I think at this point is probably appropriate.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know about predictors of response to TKIs, specifically erlotinib? Anything new in terms of the mutations and in terms of non-smoking?
I think clearly we know that there's both molecular predictors of response as well as epidemiologic predictors. So if we just go on the non-molecular observations, and we're talking mostly about second or third line non-small cell therapy, we're talking about never smokers, females, and Asians. And if you have all three of those features, your likelihood of responding is, you know, tenfold or greater than a non-Asian male heavy smoker. When you start looking at the molecular basis, you really can get down to mutations in the 19th and 22nd chromosome that I think you really can start focusing in on as very specific for this. And there's work being done both at Harvard and Sloan Kettering in Colorado that really, from my point of view, tell a story together. And together the story is that there's agreement that certain areas are very useful in terms of predicting, and other areas are probably less fuzzy. But clearly, mutational analysis is extremely helpful in the right hands. The FISH type analysis that Fred Hirsch and others have done has also been useful. But the look by the nurse at the patient probably is equally useful. You know, if you're a female and you're a never smoker, you're probably going to have a greater likelihood of response as well.
I mean, it seems like the male non-smokers do also.
Yeah, the male non-smokers have a higher likelihood of response than the smokers. Now, one of the issues that's been sort of an interesting area lately is whether having a KRAS mutation is a sufficiently adverse predictor of response so as to not use TKIs. I reviewed data recently which would really suggest that while the overall response rate using RECIST criteria is lower in KRAS mutation positive patients, there clearly is a suggestion that the range of response, sort of looking at kind of waterfall type trends, does not look visually that different in KRAS mutation patients as opposed to non-KRAS mutation patients.
Again, you're kind of looking at it from a trastuzumab perspective where, you know, you see by using HER2 positivity, using trastuzumab alone, maybe a third of the patients are going to respond with metastatic disease. You know, you look over at non-small cell with erlotinib, and to me it looks like similar, maybe even greater numbers just by saying finding that somebody's a non-smoker.
Absolutely.
Or oligosmoker, exactly. I guess less than 15 pack years. Is that your take?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that the kind of studies that are going on trying to bring erlotinib to an earlier level of care among those oligo smokers or never smokers is exactly the kind of work we should be doing. We have just one study that I know of that really looked at erlotinib in newly diagnosed patients versus chemotherapy. To me, that needs to be looked at in the right population more than once or twice.
What do you see in terms of quality of life, chemo versus erlotinib overall?
I would say in general, erlotinib's better tolerated, especially compared to doublet-based chemotherapy. And if it provides, as you say, the same palliation, the same arrest of symptoms as you might get with doublet chemotherapy in the initial, you know, if you have a never smoker or an oligo smoker in a low PS state at diagnosis, perhaps a bit on the elderly side, I would like to have data to support erlotinib as an initial management of that patient. And I think a lot of physicians want that. It's not there, but I'm hoping we get that there because I think that's an option that many patients and many families would prefer.
Let's get back to stage 3 disease.
Sure.
We talked before about the potential role of Bev moving forward in clinical trials. Where are we right now, particularly after this last ASCO meeting with the reports from the SWOG-023 and the HOG study, and where are we heading?
I think for stage 3 disease, ASCO-07 was a confusing meeting and questioned and challenged some of the basic tenets of what we've been doing for the last 5 or 10 years. In particular, the Hoosier Oncology Group, while a small study, was a well-designed study, had 2/3 of its patients PET stage, so a well-selected group of patients, had good median survival times in both arms of cisplatin etoposide radiation versus cisplatin etoposide radiation followed by 3 cycles of docetaxel, but not a shred of evidence that the docetaxel-containing arm conferred benefit, and with predictable but not unforeseen higher rate of toxicity. The one higher rate of toxicity that I think is worth mentioning because it factors in how we design trials is that the rate of pneumonitis was higher in the docetaxel-containing arm. And that supports the concern, although it hasn't really been well proven, that if you give adjuvant chemotherapy after concurrent chemoradiation, it does increase your risk of pneumonitis. Now, this was not life-threatening pneumonitis, and I'm not clear, and I'll certainly be interested in talking to Dr. Hanna as to what grades of pneumonitis this included, but the overall pneumonitis rate was higher.
Obviously, we know about anthracyclines. I can remember some things about Taxol. What do we know about docetaxel after radiation and even radiation recall of any type? I don't know if that would be radiation recall or...
Yeah, I would describe it as enhancement of treatment effect. I mean, we know almost any chemotherapy given either concurrently or after radiation has some risk of increasing the normal tissue effects of the radiation, period. Any chemo worth its weight in the vial is, and that applies whether it's etoposide, platinum, or whatever. Anthracycline and others had the more substantial radiation recall effect, but I think we know that any adjuvant therapy, particularly given in full dose, has that risk. The reality is that the pneumonitis risk was not as high as some historic studies. So I don't think.
11%, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, in the RTOG 9410, it was higher than that as it was in other historic studies. So the HOG study kind of challenges the basic SWOG 9504 regimen, but I don't think that it's a death knell for adjuvant chemotherapy after chemoradiation. It's just another bit of data to think about.
It's interesting you call it adjuvant chemotherapy because that's what I would say too. I
mean, yeah.
And the question is how much is an adequate amount? Have there been any discussions about delaying the chemotherapy, maybe waiting a month or two until the patients recover from the chemoradiation and then giving, quote, adjuvant chemotherapy?
Well, I think most of these regimens, you wait about 3 weeks. Maybe you're probably allowed to wait 4 weeks and people need that time.
What about 6 months?
The survival is such and the risk of additional tumor-related progression, it'd be tough to wait 6 months. Now, would you be better waiting 2 to 3 months? I think that's a potential. So the only other thing I'd say about adjuvant therapy is in the SWOG 9504 regimen, the cis platinum etoposide radiation regimen, those patients get relatively full-dose active chemotherapy during the chemo-rads. When you go to another regimen, such as a weekly carboplatin paclitaxel radiation regimen, I feel absolutely strongly that there needs to be adjuvant chemotherapy after that regimen. And most commonly, it's just full-dose carboplatin paclitaxel given, although some people switch to a single-agent taxane such as docetaxel, but I feel strongly that it needs to be given there because then in that regimen, there is no systemic level of chemotherapy given during the chemo-rads. What I take this to be, the HOG study, is that there can be some flexibility after chemo-radiation in the SWOG core. We're not obliged to use one and only one taxane. If we want to, if we have another active agent or another active regimen we want to test, we have some flexibility in doing that. Because if you go over to the SWOG-0023 study, where the backbone regimen was cis etoposide radiation docetaxel and then randomized people, And you have a core of 16 weeks or whatever of therapy before you even get to the randomization question. If you designed a study somewhat like that now, you don't have to have that obligatory 3 cycles of the taxane after the chemo rads.
I mean, it's interesting the way you position this as adjuvant therapy after chemo radiation, which makes a lot of sense. And when you talk about adjuvant therapy, one of the things that's an issue is what is the risk of relapse before your adjuvant therapy?
Mm-hmm.
So overall in these patients, what is the risk of relapse total after they get chemo radiation? And what specifically is their risk of metastatic disease?
You know, again, the numbers one gives on that depends on how rigorously patients are staged. An old study, one of the landmark RT versus chemo RT studies from Dr. Ariagada and Dr. Le Chevalier, they actually did bronchoscopy after chemo radiation or radiation and found a tumor in 85% of the patients. And that was with 60 gray, not that different than what we do now. So persistent tumor or recurrent tumor, it's all sort of how you define it. But we know in a typical chemo radiation regimen of good stage 3 disease, even if you don't look that hard, you're going to have 30% very visible infield progression, and you're going to have at least 50% of patients with documented distant mets. So you have two real competing risks, with distant mets being numerically higher.
So it seemed to be a fruitful area to look at the impact of chemotherapy in that situation.
Right, which is really what the HOG study did. But what I would love to see, I mean, if you say name 5 designs that might be worth doing if we had infinite resources and infinite patient availability, look at a study such as the HOG study, and rather than randomizing docetaxel against placebo, see if one of the new targeted therapies, be it a vascular targeting therapy or whatever, is useful in the post-radiation period as a way to delay tumor progression. So let me talk for a minute about the SWOG study, if you'd like. SWOG 0023, led by Karen Kelly, Laurie Gaspar, and others, really the first aggressive phase 3 trial attempt by any group to say, let's see whether a tyrosine kinase inhibitor can help the results of chemo radiation. Keep in mind that SWOG wanted to do at that time a HOG-type study of chemo radiation followed by docetaxel versus chemo radiation followed by cystotoposide. We're not allowed to do it. Would have been able to have a more highly powered study than the HOG study if they were allowed. So what they did is they took the docetaxel-containing platform and then added gefitinib versus placebo thereafter. Now, they knew, and we know, that preclinical data would suggest that if you are going to add a TKI, you really should do it concurrent with radiation. There's all kinds of preclinical data that you're going to enhance radiation sensitivity, that there's synergism. But the reason they couldn't do that at that point in time is there wasn't enough data showing that you could safely give it with chemo radiation, and therefore they moved ahead with, it's almost a post-adjuvant randomization. So the initial design of that study was to enroll about 850 patients with the expectation about 650 would be randomized. So a dropout rate of about 25%, they would then get a question as to whether gefitinib improved survival. Data Monitoring Committee closed that study in 2005, when the study crossed the futility boundary, meaning there was no possible way the gefitinib-containing arm could have been better than the placebo arm. What we see among about 600 patients enrolled and 250-ish randomized is a statistically significant inferiority in survival of this gefitinib arm. So again, what's puzzling about this is no significant enhancement of toxicity, perhaps some increase in some non-life-threatening toxicities, not a particularly different distribution in any other parameters other than survival and tumor control. What I actually question, my number one theory is that we don't know how to stratify and randomize patients 15 weeks after starting chemo radiation.
That's interesting, yeah.
This, who knows how to stratify?
Yeah.
I mean, they use the standard things we use to stratify people on day one.
Oh, interesting.
And we don't know, so it might have been a totally innocent misstratification.
I mean, that's still kind of what I'm saying in terms of lack of HER2, that
right.
I'm not saying statistical noise,
right.
but something going on that really isn't about the agent.
Right, yes, because what I, again, don't want this study to tell people, be it in pharma, NCI, FDA, or cooperative groups, oh, no sense studying biologic agents with chemo rads. Look what happened in SWOG-023. Look at how much trouble SWOG's having trying to just run a BEV study. Let's go on and look at it somewhere else.
Do they have enough non-smokers to look at them?
Don't know that one bit.
I'd like to see that trial, though. I know we never will in non-smokers or that strategy.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting.
Or mutation carriers.
What would be interesting would be to at least even stratify by smoking status in a study like that, absolutely, yeah.
Right.
So, and then going to your final question is, what should the next study be? So the next study, which I think there will be an activation or a, not an activation, but an announcement, you can put the study through the IRB tomorrow, is a new RTOG study looking at the radiation dose question in stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer. We now have data from about 4 American cooperative groups as well as a small phase 3 Chinese trial saying that if you do well-planned radiation and you give something in the range of 74 gray plus concurrent chemo rads, we're starting to see in phase 2 studies, multi-center studies, much better survival than with 60 to 63 gray.
And much better?
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at 24 to 26-month median survival time as compared to 17 with 60, 63 gray. Now, is it a stage migration or more of these people PET scanned, whatever? We'll see. But the reality is that is, I think, the most compelling phase 3 question today. Personally, I wish we were doing that plus a biologic agent, but we don't have one that we can argue we can test right now.